Firstly, I think when we've got to think about the three pillars of sustainability, because they're not mutually exclusive, and that's, you know, people, planet, and profit, or to put it another way, environmental, social, and economic. However, you use the tree analogy. I tend to use a Greek proverb when I'm trying to describe sustainability, which I find quite good, and it goes something like this: society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they know they'll never sit under, which I think is a nice way of putting sustainability. The ultimate pay it forward. Although I like your analogy of cut one tree, plant one tree, I think looking at our trajectory now, that's probably even unsustainable in itself.
That's my guest, Matthew Chalkley, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Matthew Chalkley has over 26 years of supply chain experience in the information and communication technology, or ICT, sector. Matthew has held a number of senior operational management positions within engineering, manufacturing, materials management, procurement, and customer order fulfillment. Matthew was the global program manager for IBM's Supply Chain Social and Environmental Management System and the global tactical lead for IBM's Center of Excellence for Product Environmental Compliance. Matthew currently chairs the Environmental Sustainable Electronics, or ESE, Technical Work Group for the International Electronics Manufacturing Initiative, known as INEMI. Matthew has a postgraduate diploma focused in environmental management from the University of Ulster. Now, here's my conversation with Matthew Chalkley. Matthew Chalkley, welcome to Reliability Matters. Thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
You are at your home office in Ireland, is that correct?
Yes, despite the accent, which I'm originally from Hertfordshire, which is about 30 miles north of London, I'm in my home office just west of Dublin. I've been in Ireland for 23 years now, so I have dual citizenship, so I can switch between one or the other, but yes, it's my home office in Ireland.
Okay, very good. So I'm going to ask make a very simple, maybe even naive statement. You know, when I think of sustainability, I think of just a very basic concept of cut one tree, plant another. So tell me from your perspective, what is sustainable manufacturing? What is that all about in the real world?
Sure. Well, firstly, I think when we've got to think about the three pillars of sustainability, because they're not mutually exclusive, and that's, you know, people, planet, and profit, or to put it another way, environmental, social, and economic. However, you use the tree analogy. I tend to use a Greek proverb when I'm trying to describe sustainability, which I find quite good. And it goes something like this: society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they know they'll never sit under, which I think is a nice way of putting sustainability.
The ultimate pay it forward.
Right. The ultimate pay it forward. Although I like your analogy of cut one tree, plant one tree, I think looking at our trajectory now, that's probably even unsustainable in itself. And it's, you know, if we increasingly look at the average global earth and sea temperatures, which was trying to keep globally for the UN target under 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, I think we're sitting around 1.1, 1.2 degrees today. And we're set to breach that by 2030. Now they're even talking about 2 degrees, which could be a couple of decades later, and that has a profound effect on our planet once we get to 2 degrees. So it may be more than one tree we need to plant if we cut one down, so to speak.
Make up for those who didn't do that, right?
Absolutely. And we also need to consider population growth when we're looking at sustainability. I mean, I'm 51 years old, and when I was born, there was only about 3.1 billion people on the planet. It's now, I think at the last count, around 7.3 billion. And you know, we could edge to 10 billion in the next couple of decades, and all of those folks on the planet are consumers of resources, whether that's energy, fresh water, food, or even products. So, you know, it's the one tree, cut one tree, plant one tree is going to be a challenge. We really need to take a step back and see, you know, how can we maintain our existence. So so that's from a sustainability perspective. When it comes to manufacturing, I think we need to look at that in the context of cost and societal and environmental issues as we create our products. I mean, we obviously business is there to make money, unless non-profit. But we got to do that in a way that minimizes the negative environmental impacts and social impacts as well, whilst taking into consideration the community we're working in and our employees as well. So, you know, I think there's a lot we can do within a manufacturing to contribute to that sustainability objective.
Yeah, absolutely. And as manufacturers consider sustainable manufacturing, should they be aware that there may be added costs, or there are savings, or is there a combination of both? Is it a net neutral, or is there any gain at all? So I guess my long-winded question is, what are the added costs when someone contemplates sustainable manufacturing, and or what are the savings, tangible and non-tangible?
Right. And I guess the answer is it depends. It depends on how far you really want to go. If you're in an organization that hasn't looked at sustainability at all, I know most organizations have in one form or another, and you start focusing on the little things, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit there that doesn't require, for example, a high capital expenditure. Just by the very fact that you focus on it, you can make a contribution. The tangible versus non-tangible savings will depend on how much you're going to invest, but it really does need a top-down, bottom-up approach. I think, you know, top management executive need to believe in it and support it and take ownership, but you also need employee engagement. I've seen throughout my career, and at one point I managed a global green team where we had you know, volunteers within the organization from engineering, manufacturing, logistics, inventory management, that we put a program in place that for them to identify opportunities to contribute to our sustainability objectives. And that could be you know, writing some code on a testing system that powers down whatever you're testing it to an idle situation for a period of time, thus saving energy. It could be looking at opportunities to use sustainable packaging, or as you get incoming parts, is there opportunity to work with the supplier to, you know, ship those parts in with a 10 per as opposed to 5 per, as long as you're not damaging those parts. So having the employees help you, you can establish some sustainability objectives and goals. So the added cost, I mean, obviously, if you're looking at investing in significant infrastructure, whether, you know, your heating, ventilation and air conditioning unit may be old and inefficient, and that's going to require quite a lot of investment. But you know, if your ROI could pay for it within 2 or 3 years, depending on how much you want to put up, and you know, then you can actually use that to promote your sustainability goals and how you've achieved against those goals. And that's where you get into the non-tangible benefits. You know, you our clients, our investors. Investors are looking to decarbonize their portfolios. So you could, you know, if you sing from the top of the hill about your sustainability objectives, as long as you're not greenwashing, and they're true, then you know that can attract clients and investors. You've obviously got to meet your regulatory and legal obligations, and there's various ways of doing that. And then if you look at the millennials and Generation Z, these are the guys and girls that want to work for sustainable companies. So you attract the top talent, and then you can increase your brand value as well, which opens up new business opportunities and into new markets. So, it depends on how far you want to go, but I think having that top management buy-in and then employee engagement will help you in that plan phase. And then I would say that, you know, to have some sort of framework in place or management system is important too, because that will guide you. I'm more familiar with the ISO 14001 environmental management system, and that's what we followed. But there are others out there that you can use. But, you know, having that plan, do, check, act model of continued improvement will help you identify what your environmental aspects are, those which are significant, those which you can influence, and those which you control. And that's the very first stage. It may be water conservation, it could be energy conservation, it could be packaging, it could be meeting legal compliance. There's many aspects you may choose to identify, and that really starts you on your journey, because once you've identified them, you can start measuring, and then you can start improving, and then you can start communicating.
Yeah, excellent. You talked about the three pillars of sustainable manufacturing: people, planet, profit. On the latter, on profit, do you think customers, well, let me back up a little bit. I fly, well, back in the day when there were airplanes in the sky, I do a lot of travel, and I go to the UK a lot, and my airline of choice for the UK is Virgin Atlantic. And they always, and I think other airlines do this too, they'll offer, when you buy your ticket, you can click a little box and pay a tiny bit extra and buy carbon offsets for your flight. Right. So that, I guess, if everyone on the plane bought a carbon offset, then they're planting trees somewhere in Brazil, whatever, however that system works. So clearly consumers have a desire to make the world a better place, or to choose their products and the manufacturers of their products and their vendors that are maybe more sustainable than others. So do you think that are consumers demanding more eco-friendly products? And do you think consumers are willing to pay a small premium, or a premium in any way, for a product they know is made in a sustainable manner?
Yeah, I do. I think we're at an inflection point, right? I mean, I don't think we can broad brush the whole of society and say that everyone's going to be willing to do that. But if you're communicating well and you're transparent in how you're going to, you know, offset or use that additional money to make your product more sustainable, or the way you manufacture your product more sustainable, or you're going to focus on the circular economy, or to reuse the product multiple times, or how you reclaim materials at the end of its natural life. If you communicate well, then that obviously makes it easier to justify the extra money that you are asking for that service or for that product. I do think generationally, like I said, for if you want to attract the top talent into your organization, the millennials and Generation Z, unfortunately, I don't like to say they're the folks that are going to be around longer than sure. Myself. So that, you know, they care more, and so they should. And we've seen over the last couple of years with Greta Thunberg and the strike for climate change campaigns that have been going on around the world. I mean, it's amazing how many kids have mobilized. And these are the these are the future Mark Zuckerbergs and Larry Ellisons. I mean, these are the guys in that are going to drive industry into the future. So, yeah, I think it's definitely changing. You know, starting probably with food products and fair trade, but now it's getting into all sorts of industries, particularly the IT. I mean, you look at automotive and the amount of electric vehicles that we see on the roads now. It's amazing.
Yeah, excellent. So you have a lot of experience in sustainable manufacturing. You worked with IBM for many years. You were their global program manager for their supply chain social and environmental management systems, and you were the global technical lead for IBM Center for Excellence for Product Environmental Compliance. So without giving away any proprietary, you know, we want to keep you alive, without giving away anything IBM proprietary, what were some of the small and some of the large things that IBM did to promote sustainable manufacturing and environmental management that mere mortal companies, you know, much smaller than IBM, might be able to learn from?
Sure. Well, I mean, the environment, the manufacturing footprint of IBM is not what it was many years ago. I mean, now IBM is marketed predominantly as a cloud, big data analytics, AI company with lots of services. That being said, there's still, you know, $12-15 billion of products that they place in the market every year, but the manufacturing presence maybe not as what it was a number of years ago. But firstly, you know, having purely from a manufacturing perspective, and as I mentioned previously, having I led a global green team that was focused on motivating employees to come up with ideas and solutions to we called them, you know, we targeted financial savings, but they had to be related to environmental goals and objectives. So, you know, like I said, with the example of writing some code to put a system in idle during test cycles, can save have some energy. You know, if an individual came up with that idea, we'd monetize that idea as a way of creating a baseline to compare to see what sort of savings was made. I think that was really beneficial, and we had an awards program in place, but the uptake and the enthusiasm for that program was something to behold, and you know, it even spilled out to work with our suppliers, and you know, we had folks that would identify inbound products that were, you know, packaged not as efficiently as they could have been. You know, we could have got 100 per when it was coming in at 50 per. We worked with our suppliers and they changed it, and then they passed on those same changes to their other clients. So it had this waterfall effect. So that was from a green team perspective. But then around 2009, we had a number of different programs within our supply chain focus on social and environmental matters. And we brought them all together under one management system within our integrated supply chain, which was the organization at the time. So that included global logistics environmental programs. It included product environmental compliance, which I can cover momentarily. Sourcing, some of our sourcing goals. One of the sourcing goals IBM has is to source 100% of its cut sheet paper and wood and paper based packaging from certified sustainably managed forests. So that's another goal that we tracked. And then we also had, developed a set of 8 requirements for all of our suppliers to adhere to as a condition of doing business, which was rolled out over a couple of years. And there are 8 requirements, and they include things like we're looking for our supplier to create their own social and environmental management system. We want them to meet all the regulatory and legal requirements, as well as any contractual requirements they have with us. We want them to measure their environmental aspects at a minimum, energy conservation, scope 1, scope 2 greenhouse emissions and waste, and then set goals to reduce those impacts. We don't prescribe how much they need to reduce, because these set of 8 requirements are equally applicable to our production procurement, i.e. the manufacturing suppliers, as they are to our non-production suppliers, so hoteliers, transportation companies, caterers, stationery suppliers. We also look for transparency. So, if we want the supplier to be publicize their goals, their measurements, their achievements, which is a good thing, because then that can also help them attract additional investment and clients. And then, pass these same set of requirements onto their suppliers that provide anything that was material to the products and services provided to IBM. This is a program that has been in place since for 10 years now, successfully, and we have a management system around that. But it really uses the significant spend that IBM has to influence the supply chain in a positive way. At the time we rolled it out, we had 28,000 suppliers in 90 plus countries, and a spend of 30 billion. So that's a lot of influence. And if you wanted to do business with IBM, then you'd have to commit to meeting these requirements. So that really does have a positive impact on the supply chain. It's not easy. It's not easy to do, and had to do a lot of education internally and then also externally for our suppliers. But it has a big impact, and IBM has really been a leader in this space for decades. In fact, in the late 60s, Thomas Watson Jr., the son of the former founder of IBM, let's say, and CEO, made our first statement on corporate citizenship, and that was in the late 60s. And that was only a few years after Rachel Carson wrote her book, Silent Spring, which kicked off the modern day environmental movement, arguably. So, we've been at this for, half a century.
Yeah. It sounds like it. A leader, really, in that right. field. So you talked about kind of the downflow, making sure your vendors, your suppliers are doing things that would fall into the realm of sustainable manufacturing. In the world of the modern world of electronics, one of the issues that we have with components are counterfeit components. And, everyone has the ability to cheat. That's not going to go away, not naive. But when it comes to certifying your suppliers as being sustainable manufacturers, is that an issue? Has that become the new counterfeit component? Are there suppliers out there, or have you had experience with suppliers out there, without naming them, that kind of fake the sustainable manufacturing side in order to gain favor with an IBM or a company they really want to do business with under the guise of sustainable manufacturing? And how does an average company verify? Are there besides ISO regulations and certifications, are there other very specific certifications that have some teeth to them that vendors or manufacturers can subscribe to ensure their customers that they are building in a sustainable manner?
Yeah, that's a good question. From our perspective, there's the requirements or objective or goals that I described previously, but also they're built into the contractual terms of our suppliers. And then, like I mentioned, we have a management system to audit the data for a subsection of those suppliers. So we'll do sampling and we'll do regular review. But notwithstanding that, there's also, if a supplier is onboarding with the organization for the first time, there's a very robust review that, covering all aspects, you know, for financial liquidity and, you know, have they got any, have they had any legal issues, plus the sustainable aspects that we require of them. And I think you need to we need to separate the service suppliers versus the IT type suppliers or the components. When it comes to let's say component or sub-assembly suppliers, then we go a lot deeper, because we have to ensure that when the part number, once we've got the supplier on board, then we get down to the part number level, and those parts have to be qualified to ensure that they meet not only the product safety, electromagnetic compatibility, where applicable, homologation or telecommunication requirements, but also the environmental requirements as prescribed by the laws and regulations that we the company place our products on, in you know, which markets we place our products on. And if you're in the EU, that's very challenging, because the products will have to meet you know, REACH and ROHS requirements or ROS requirements. They have to meet battery requirements, extended producer responsibility requirements. They have to meet energy and power, and more recently what we're seeing is eco design and circular economy requirements. So the qualification of those parts, we do look for a lot more data to ensure that they are compliant, because if they're going into our product, it's our product that we're placing on the market in those jurisdictions, so we hold the liability if those parts have been misrepresented. And you know, if you look at ROHS, I mean, it started off in circa 2004 with four substances, and now we're up to 10 substances. And then you have the exemptions that expire every 1 to 2 years. So we have to make sure that we clean our supply chain and replace those components or parts with compliant products to ensure that we can continue to place those products on the market. So, there's a whole field of qualification and obtaining declarations from the supplier. Obviously, we don't take the components and destroy them and extract the chemicals. The EU, for example, is based on self-declaration. So, you know, we have to trust the integrity of the supplier with all the checks we've done previously, and then the validation through their own declarations will assure us that what they're providing to us is going to meet the requirements.
It sounds like the EU is a little ahead of the world on sustainable manufacturing with all of these EU mandates that you just cited. Is that your take? Is the EU ahead of North America and other countries in terms of certifications and the requirements for environmental and sustainable manufacturing?
My personal opinion would be yes, they are. There are some jurisdictions that advance in specific areas, but when you look at it holistically, the EU is ahead of, for example, if you look at REACH, which is the registration, evaluation, authorization and restriction of chemicals, that has reporting requirements. for substances of very high concern, which are toxic, mutagenic, carcinogenic, you know, nasty stuff that we want to eradicate out of our supply chain. We have to declare the quantities of those SVHCs in our products, like every other organization that places product on the market in the EU has to. And there's 215 substances to evaluate, and that list is growing every year. As we speak, there's a new database that's been created, which will require, again, all organizations that place product on the market, whether it's a producer, manufacturer, or distributor, to declare those SVHCs or publicize those SVHCs to this database. But it's not even at a sub-assembly or an OEM level, it's right down to the article level, which is where a substance and a mixture comes together to form an object. So that's the current understanding, and there's some ongoing discussions, but this database will be, you know, huge. I get why they're doing it, right? So it's to have to know what's on the market. So that's far beyond what other jurisdictions have done. But you do see from time to time jurisdictions going beyond even the EU. There was a flame retardant used in acoustic phones that was acoustic foam. That was prohibited in Washington, D.C. So obviously that's where there's a lot of federal business. So, you know, we took the decision to remove it from our supply chain. That one substance, it took, nearly a couple of years to do that. So that's just one substance. Canada at the moment are looking at prohibiting a couple of flame retardants. And they haven't put a lower threshold, which means that and they're used in PCB laminates, they're used in cables and, you know, other components. So, but there isn't good alternatives, supply of good alternatives for the industry to replace those flame retardants at the moment. So my opinion, if they continue along this trajectory, which goes far beyond any other jurisdiction, it's going to bring down their whole electronics industry, right? Because I truly believe that nobody will be able to meet this requirement in a short period of time. Maybe over 4 or 5 years they can, but and that's not just IT product, that's white goods, that's aerospace, that's automotive, it's medical. So it's a very complex environment. When we look at RoHS, which the EU, you know, was evolved in the EU, I would say it's best in class. We would like to think that jurisdictions would take RoHS and implement it verbatim, right? But we see small changes. We saw it in India, we've seen it in the United Arab Emirates, and that drives challenges, because then you've got to customize every RoHS program. This is on the assumption that you're a global supplier, to meet the requirements for each jurisdiction. So sure. It's a very challenging environment, and now EU is leading with framework for circular economy and the eco design directive, which is looking at other aspects, including, you know, material reclamation, providing disassembly instructions, which is something we haven't seen before. So an organization has to provide information on the number of fasteners. How do you disassemble the product?
So they have to have a manual on how to start up the product and use the product, and then they have to have a manual of how to basically prepare it for death, right? How to take it apart, how to access some of the materials that have to be recycled separately. Right. Is that the purpose of that?
recycling and reuse and making available for secondary markets. I mean, it's probably obvious when you look at the mobile phone market, right? That's, and you've got to balance that with safety as well, because you know if you try and remove a lithium battery and you do it incorrectly, you could injure yourself or cause a fire. I mean, that's why we have restrictions on lithium batteries in air freight. So you know there's balances that have to be made here, but it's certainly the closed loop circular economy is where it's going. That this is the next evolution of sustainability that's going to impact manufacturing and supply chain. And I think it's in a good way, but you always have to. I always like to think about balance. So it's not always as Boolean as you would think. Obviously, with RoHS, a little bit less lead in the world is obviously a good thing. But you've also then got to look at if there's a prohibition that is coming into effect, and there hasn't been enough research for an alternative substance or material, then you could potentially just drive all that product to scrap. So then, you're increasing the levels of e-waste. So you're eliminating a substance, but then you also create an e-waste, which has other materials.
Sure. You talk about incorporated. Talk about mercury. Just reminded me when I was in high school in my physical science class, the teacher used to had a bottle of mercury, and he'd have all the students cup their hands, and he'd pour a drop of mercury in each student's hand. And we would transport it from one hand to the other hand to the other hand and wiggle our hands around and watch this little ball of mercury wiggle around our hands. And when we were done with that experience, we would all go up to the teacher and kind of cup it back into the bottle again. And now we're really worried about mercury, which I totally get. But it's funny. Yeah. We used to play with it, and it was a article of amusement, really. You also talked about going back a few things you said about some of the regulations that different countries are coming out with, and how they differ slightly or majorly from other countries' regulations, and that. I think you made a comment that, in the future, it might be impossible for the electronics industry to comply with all of these regulations. That brings me back to 1989. I started in our industry in 85, so 1989 was a major part of our industry. In fact, that's what started the company that I founded, that I still operate today, and that was the Montreal Protocol, where 11 countries got together in Montreal and just kind of said, we don't want any CFC. We don't want certain CFC, chlorofluorocarbon-based solvents anymore, or other products that contain that. So we're going to give the world 10 years to stop making these things. And one of the two of the major solvents used to clean circuit boards after soldering were 111 trichloroethane and Freon TMS, both on the government's hit list. And no one thought it would be real. It would just be like the government today saying, hey, guys, in 10 years, no more gasoline. And everyone would go, yeah, okay, we'll get out of the treaty. We'll poke holes in it. It won't really happen. So everyone assumed this would fall apart. Even though the treaty was ratified, everyone assumed it would fall apart. And as we got closer to the 10-year phase out, our industry trade magazines on their front covers had a countdown to the Montreal Protocol, 11 months to the Montreal Protocol, 10 months, 9 months, 8. And we predicted the fall of the electronics industry in first world country and in subscribers to the Montreal Protocol. We figured everyone will just go overseas where they didn't sign onto the Montreal Protocol, and that will kill manufacturing in many countries. And it was doom and gloom. And you know what happened? No clean flux came out of that. Alternative solvents came out of that.
Right.
And the irony is there's only been two treaties that have been ratified by 100% of all UN member countries. One was the Geneva Convention and the other was the Montreal Protocol. Today, we could write a treaty that said, let's just all agree that the sun comes up in the morning and goes down in the evening. And we couldn't get all those countries to agree. We're a polarized society now. And, you know, it's just really interesting that one of the only two ever 100% ratified treaties through the UN, one of them was an environmental treaty. Who would have guessed? You know, the U.S. right now is busy getting out of environmental treaties. And I won't go into the efficacy of that because that's not the nature of the show. I'll lose at least half my audience. But, you know, it's interesting that one of the biggest treaties, one of the most adopted treaties and ratified treaties is an environmental treaty. And it happened in our lifetime. You know, it happened in 1989.
I think it'd be great if we could, you know, revisit that type of treaty. It would, you know, from an industry perspective, whether you're an environmentalist or not, it makes economic sense because you don't have, you know, satellite countries all doing their own thing. Even if you could get, you know, the G countries to agree, and others would follow because it, you know, there's no point in them investing to be maverick and put their own stamp on it. So I think that would be, because then research could all align. And you can get these other technologies, all these other materials. What the challenge is today is just, you know, it's so discombobulated, and you have countries and jurisdictions that want to be seen as a leader, so they put their own little spin on what works, what's best in class, to customize it for their, you know, to say this is ours, this is what we're doing. But, you know, it puts an awful burden on industry. And I'm talking from a multinational blue chip perspective. If you're in the small to medium sized enterprise, it's even more challenging. And these organizations are just going to have, you know, they will just make risk based decisions. I think what came out, it's interesting you say the Montreal treaty, because in the 80s, late 80s, I worked for Motorola on the manufacturing line. I was a technician back in the day. I used to work on the surface mount machines and solder baths, and we used to clean our solder paste off our PCB boards in Freon ultrasonic tanks. And
right.
When one would drop through the grate, I used to lean over and pick it up, and you'd get a few head spins from that. And, you know, you didn't give it a second look because you didn't really understand. So at least now we've got rid of those chemicals. And you know, you could say the same for lead and lead-free solders. I mean,
sure.
What has changed in just a really short space of time has been driven by you know, organizations and countries working together. What makes it really difficult is when there's not the timeline is too tight and the technology hasn't been developed, or the materials haven't been developed. Because again, I come back to what you don't want to do is go and create tons and tons of e-waste, because you can't replace those.
Sure.
Those products effectively.
Sure. Yeah, it has to be a complete holistic approach, not just solve one problem, create
right.
another. I always thought there was what I called the two green, 2M theory of why people are attracted to sustainable manufacturing. The two greens would be either the environmental green, that they just really want to become a more environmentally responsible company, or the currency green. And, you know, they're either chasing, you know, a green planet, or they see a value in the profit side, the money side. And that stems from two M's, either morality or money, right? So maybe a little bit of both. If you go after sustainable manufacturing for the money, you're still going to make the world a greener place. So, you know, you can get the morality button for free, even if that wasn't your motivation. But there are multiple reasons why I think people choose to chase sustainable manufacturing and just environmental responsibility in general, and it involves money and morality. And any one will give you the same result, which is great. Let's talk a little bit about your role with INEMI. Mm. You chair the INEMI Environmental Sustainable Electronics ESE Technical Work Group. What's the goal of this group, and how does it how does this work benefit manufacturing at large?
Yeah, absolutely. So for those listeners that don't know, INEMI is the International Electronic Manufacturing Initiative. This initiative has been developing industry roadmaps for over 20 years. And it's grown from, I think it had six chapters in the early 90s, and there's 28 chapters now. And every couple of years, the roadmaps are published, and with over 2,000 pages of content. And you know, these roadmaps are an important tool for defining like state of the art in electronic industry, as well as identifying emerging and disruptive technologies. And projects where the membership can work on or even research and development priorities covering the next decade. So each of these roadmaps is built on processes of lessons learned from previous editions. And as I said, it's a global collaborative effort that involves individuals from organizations who are leading in their respective fields and represent many perspectives of the electronics manufacturing supply chain. And I've been involved since 2014, 2015. I chair the Sustainable Electronics Map. It's a really excellent initiative. So if you're in one organization, you can tend to be a little bit blinkered and see your own perspective. So this gives an opportunity to work with competitors, suppliers, clients in their organizations, as well as academia, collectively understanding the industry today and where it's going, and you know, maybe even developing some projects and research which can benefit all members in the future. So the chapter, the good thing about the chapters as well, whichever chapter you look at out of the 2,000 plus pages, all has a common structure. So it focuses on situational analysis, so looking at the climate today, identification of any business and technology needs and critical issues, and then these help form the basis to identify gaps and potential showstoppers, albeit it's rare that we identify an actual showstopper. And then this leads to the recommendations, which in another process is evaluated by a separate team to identify projects and research opportunities. And the last chapter I led along with co-chairs Leo Kenny and Carol Hanworker, we had 29 folks from 22 organizations, including academia, and our roadmap was about 90 pages in content, and we divided it into four sections. We looked at sustainability holistically, so a little bit like we talked about at the start of this interview, eco design and circular economy, materials. And we used to have a section called recycling, but we've updated the title of recycling to electronics value recovery. So it's more aligned with the circular economy now, which is we've modernized it. We did used to have a dedicated section on energy, but in the last cycle of the roadmap, we couldn't get enough volunteers. And I do stress this is volunteers from these organizations that work on this roadmap, which I think makes it pretty special. So we didn't have a dedicated section on energy, so we incorporated energy conservation content into the sustainability section. But projects that have evolved from this roadmap includes an eco impact assessment tool that was developed. There's a phase two of a project looking at value recovery from electronics at its end of life, looking at hard drives, for example, neodymium in magnets, and then developing common recycling metrics as well. There's another project that's gone for a couple of phases and is looking to start phase three in developing recycling metrics on, you know, taking factors like, you know, how easy is it to liberate components from a product when it hits the value recovery stage of the life cycle. So really good process, and you know, it's nice when you it requires an investment in time, but it is nice to be able to work with like-minded colleagues in other organizations on you know, common challenges that affect the industry. And so the sustainability roadmap is well subscribed, well downloaded, and it's one of the most popular ones out of the full portfolio of roadmaps within INEMI.
Excellent. Is INEMI working closely with the automotive industry on any roadmaps or any other type of endeavor?
I believe at a high level, INEMI would work with any industry sector that has electronics, right? So it's and there are roadmaps dedicated to, for example, to IoT. I think there's medical and automotive in there. You know, I was so busy on the sustainable, I didn't get an opportunity to look at the others. But
yeah, on the sustainable front with automotive, I'm thinking, you know, every year around the world, millions of cars are built, right? Which means in the circle of life, every year around the world, millions of cars are destroyed, are put to rest. And I can just think of the old days of, you know, when your car hit the junk pile, it literally got towed in or sometimes driven in. You know, the trunk and the glove compartment were emptied of valuables and the car was crushed and, you know, thrown in a landfill or wherever it went, in a shredder or whatever. Now, with millions of cars going out of service, well, maybe not today because millions of cars aren't quite as electronically equipped, you know, if they're being destroyed today. In the next several years, as all of our modern cars, which have a bill of materials where 30% of that bill of materials is electronics, and that's expected to go up to 50%, that's a lot of electronics being crushed and put into the ground. So I would imagine there, if any industry is looking at a, you know, deconstruction sustainable roadmap, the automotive industry is probably looking at that as well.
Yes, we didn't have any direct involvement in our roadmap because it was predominantly focused on ICT. But you're 100% right. I mean, electronics is ubiquitous now. It's in everything. You know, so there has to be new ways of liberating and recovering, especially when a lot of these materials are, you know, fall into the category of rare earth elements or they're valuable. You know, and even the sourcing of some of those minerals. You know, we've got programs in place to make sure that they're not sourced from conflict regions around the world, predominantly, as we are aware, is the Democratic Republic of Congo for tin, tungsten, tantalum, gold, and more recently cobalt, right? So, you know, there's less of these materials and substances available. So it's going to be really important to liberate those materials from whatever electronic product, whether it's the car that goes through the shredder,
right,
or the white goods or consumer electronics, whatever the case may be.
Very good. Well, we are out of time. I had more questions for you, so maybe I can talk you into coming back again in the future and we can continue the conversation.
I'd love to come back at a later date and talk again. I mean, cool. This subject is dear to me. It's of great interest, and it's so vast that you could talk forever on it, to be honest. I think getting that awareness out there is really important. And even for folks that are not as motivated by environmental issues, just being lean, getting rid of your muda, can save you dollars. And if that doesn't motivate you, what will?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the company I own is we started based on environmental regulation. We've always had a green mind from day one, because I'm very thankful for government regulation. We were able to exploit that in a positive way.
Right.
We are a green company. We save the planet, and or at least make the planet a little better than how we were given it. So, and I think that's a savvy business approach. Whether you're an environmentalist or not, I guess I'm more of an environmentalist than not. Sometimes if my recycle bin is full, I'll throw the recycle stuff in a regular bin. I have to admit, I'm not perfect. But I do think it's a savvy move to at least consider the environment, because there are business opportunities there, even if there's no morality-driven decisions. Matthew Chalkley, thank you so much for being my guest today. You are talking about one of my favorite subjects, which is sustainability and environmental responsibility. My company started by seeing an opening based on government regulation, environmental regulation, and it's been a good journey for the last 28 years. So I think there's definitely a strategic and a savvy advantage for companies to consider sustainable manufacturing and environmental responsibility, because I think now more than ever, we make money on that because we sell products that are environmentally responsible. Our customers benefit from that because it keeps them out of trouble. Right? They don't get the EPA walking up their pipes. And I think more now than ever, consumers are demanding that their products be built in factories that treat their team well, that don't damage the earth and things like that. I think the younger generations, as you mentioned earlier, the millennials and the Gen Zers of the world are going to be the consumers of the future, and they're going to drive that. And if we are building things today and we want to become their customers tomorrow, now's the time to start thinking about that.
100%. Oh, I've really enjoyed it. I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk to you today and to the listeners. This is a subject that I'm also very passionate about. I think, we get one go on this merry-go-round, but we've got to make sure that others can have a go as well.
Yeah, very good. If our audience want to reach out to you, and contact you and ask you further questions, what's the best way to do that? Would that be email?
Sure, yes. I can give you my email address. It's chalklem19@gmail.com. So that's chalklem for Matthew, 19@gmail.com.
Very good. And for our listeners, Matthew's information will be in our show notes. So click on the link to Spreaker.com and look up Reliability Matters, and you'll find the show notes right there. I think you can also get our show notes on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts as well. So again, Matthew, thank you for giving me a good solid hour of your time. I really appreciate it. And I wish you health and safety in these pandemic times. Hopefully we'll see the end of this soon. Or at least we'll find whatever the new normal is to be acceptable and all of that. So stay well, and thank you again for being my guest. I look forward to talking to you again on part two of sustainability.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. A special thanks to Circuits Assembly Magazine and Ascendo Reliability for syndicating this show, and where you can listen to this and other interesting podcasts on PCBChat.com and Reliability.fm. Thanks for your questions and episode suggestions. Please keep them coming. Send comments to mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Reliability Matters. Once again, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.